The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those sentiments from Gramsci, as roughly paraphrased by Zizek, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. So this week, I wanted to take up the ongoing controversy over the New York Times and its coverage of trans issues. There's a letter that had been written by freelancers or writers for the Times objecting to some of the ways in which the Times has covered debates about transgender issues. And there was an accompanying letter from LGBTQ human rights groups. The Times has kind of taken a very hard stance against this. I think to understand what's going on, it's perhaps important to have a context of the larger history of the way that the Times has dealt with such issues. And for that reason, I'm very happy to have on as a guest, Jack Merkinson, who is a senior editor at The Nation and co-founder of Discourse Blog, and wrote a long piece for The Nation about the Times's coverage, particularly of what we could call gay rights and also AIDS. But let's start from the current moment and then maybe go into the past history of this. So Jack, do you want to say something about, just what is the this letter? Well, there's two letters, but let's talk about the letter from the people who are writers for the Times. What's basically the gist of this? And we should mention you're a signatory to this letter.
Yes, I was not a signatory to the initial letter, which was from Times contributors. I've never written for the Times, so I don't count. But then people could sign on in support of the letter, and I did that. The Times coverage of trans issues and trans people, particularly in the last year or so, has been sort of increasingly criticized for its tone and for its sourcing and for lots of other reasons. People have been sort of growing more and more alarmed about the seeming animus that is sort of shot through all of these stories. There's this very, very sort of distressed tone that you find in a lot of these Times stories, like, are trans people are here and how are we supposed to think about that? Is it a problem? Are there too many trans people? Are there too many trans children? Are there too many trans children, transitioning or getting medicine? A bunch of people who are Times contributors, I think by now it's over 1,000 Times contributors have signed this letter. Initially, it was about 170 or so. So they sent this open letter to the standards editor of the New York Times saying, basically, we are contributors to the Times, and we are very, very concerned about your coverage of trans people and trans issues. And at the same time, GLAAD, the LGBTQ rights group, sent a separate letter to the Times, basically saying the same thing. In response, the Times first dismissed both letters, very oddly sort of pretended that the GLAAD letter and the letter from journalists who had contributed to the newspaper itself were the same, said about both of them, these are letters from advocacy groups and activists, and we are not activists of the Times. We are journalists, and we are just going where the facts find us, where the facts lead us, sorry. And we do not really see what you're saying. And at the same time, the leadership within the paper, the executive editor and the opinion editor, sent a joint letter internally because a handful of Times staffers had signed on to the letter, and they said, we will not tolerate any Times employees joining with advocacy groups trying to pressure the New York Times about its coverage. So the response from the Times has been basically, A, you don't know what you're talking about, and there's nothing wrong with our coverage of trans issues. And B, if you work for us and you have decided to speak out about your objections to our coverage, then you now sort of have a target on your back internally, and we are watching to see what happens next. So that's what's been going on in the past, week and a half.
I believe there's been some reporting that there's been some disciplinary actions, or some people have been sort of, called in, or so there might even be like sort of repercussions within the paper. Now, there's a couple of things that one could say about the Times' response. One of which is like to immediately discount advocacy or activists and say, well, that's illegitimate towards journalism. Whereas, like one can take a broad view of the history of journalism, and there have often been advocacy groups that have taken issue with things that have appeared in newspapers, and often for very good reasons. And often newspapers end up admitting that they were wrong. I mean, one can just look at the sort of, coverage of immigration and Jewish issues in the 19th and early 20th century, the coverage of African-Americans. There's always been a long tradition of advocates being critical. And I think oftentimes their criticism has been on point and is now acknowledged on point.
Right. I'll just add another one to that about the New York Times. The New York Times now acknowledges that it underplayed the Holocaust during the 1930s and 1940s, that it did not report sufficiently that the Holocaust was happening, and that's a very big one to get wrong. And at the time, I would imagine that the New York Times was similarly resistant to criticism of its Holocaust coverage, but now it's viewed as a real period of shame at the paper.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. There's been many such cases, and so that. And in fact, we're going to get to another one for the bulk of our conversation. But just like as a premise, the idea that you can discount anything coming from activists or advocacy groups seems suspect. And then, as you notice, they tried to conflate the criticism that was coming from journalists who were writing as Times contributor and saying that they didn't feel that the coverage was good journalism, conflating that with the GLAAD complaint, which is coming from a different place.
I should just add very briefly, because I forgot to mention this part, is that the News Guild of New York, which represents Times employees, issued a statement in support of the people who had been speaking out and saying that their speech was protected workplace speech. They were raising complaints about the workplace environment, and so they could not be punished for making that decision. And in response to that, a bunch of different Times journalists issued their own open letter criticizing the News Guild and criticizing the idea really that there was anything wrong with Times coverage. And again, repeating the management line saying, we are not activists, we are journalists. So this idea of activism versus journalism is a real thread running through not only the response from the management, but also the response from some other journalists within the Times itself.
That's exactly on point. And I would just add to that a little bit about this issue of the journalists who are working for the Times, who are critical of the newspaper, because the Times editorially has written a lot about cancel culture and about threats to free speech. And they actually do have an editorial where they say the threat to free speech is not just coming from the government, but exists in civil society and includes employers not allowing free speech, within the workplace. So that is the official, editorial voice of the Times, is saying that there should be more free speech in the workplace. And I don't think that's congruent at all with the way the Times has handled this matter.
Right.
So there's obviously a lot of problems or contradictions within the Times' handling of this. I think this is where your piece for the Nation, which I'll link to, which is like a very substantial, lengthy piece, which offers a very useful context for thinking about this, because the whole argument of the Times is one of professionalism. You know, we're journalists, we're following the rules of journalism, we know what we're doing, and the people who are critical of us are advocates and activists, and they don't know. And if that's the argument, then, you know, one should say, like, well, what's the basis for thinking that the Times, their code of professionalism is always leads them to the right position on issues like this? What is a is there a reason for thinking that this we're journalists, we're professionals, that is a sufficient answer to criticism, and that if the Times just, you know, if we just trust in their professionalism, everything will be all right? Well, you know, I think your piece, which is really about the history of the way that the Times has covered you know, the broader sexual identity issues with gays and lesbians, I think it really shows that no, there's no reason to, like, you know, rely on their professional expertise as the ultimate answer. Let's get into some of this. Like, how would you what's the broad sweep of the story that you're telling?
Yeah, so one of the things that has really struck me about the Times' response to this sort of criticism is not only that, you know, it has its backup and that it's incredibly defensive and dismissive and patronizing towards its critics, you know, that I suppose to a certain extent is to be expected from the Times when it gets criticized, but that all of these things played out in almost exactly the same way 30 or 40 years ago around the Times coverage of very similar issues, specifically around the emergence of the gay liberation movement and then the emergence of the AIDS crisis. The same beats you can just see in the history playing out over and over again. And the really important part of this to me is that now, all these years later, the Times sort of officially considers its coverage of LGBTQ rights and AIDS in the 70s and 80s and, you know, into the early 90s. To be one of its low points, one of the low points in its history. You know, and the Times has, you know, issued repeated mea culpas, multiple articles detailing the internal homophobia that was all over the place within the paper, detailing the way that the Times did not cover the emergence of AIDS or the AIDS movement in the way that, the paper should have, you know, and admitting we got this one very wrong. It was driven, you know, in part by institutional bigotry, and we wish we had done it differently. And so to see the Times on the one hand sort of have to be forthright about that aspect of its history, and at the same time making what, to my mind at least, is an almost identical series of errors in its coverage of another marginalized queer group, this time trans people, you know, and reacting to the criticism of that coverage with the same instinctive sort of dismissal and hostility that it displayed when it was criticized over its coverage of gay rights and AIDS in the 80s, you know, to me that is sort of an astonishing inability from within the Times to see how it is repeating its own mistakes and to learn anything from its own history. And so what I wrote about was basically, first, what was that history? You know, how did the Times get that coverage wrong? And then why it matters that the Times can, on the one hand, seemingly acknowledge that history, and on the other hand, seemingly fail to learn any lessons from that history.
Yeah, that's right. And I think I want to go into some of the little granular details, because I think that they're very important for maybe understanding the dynamics of the present as well. One of which is, like, you know, I mean, I think it's fair enough to say that there was, like, a broader cultural homophobia that was existed in many places, including in the Nation magazine, you know, in the early 20th century. And, you know, like, the Times's coverage of that sort of stuff is perhaps of the norm. Of that period of, like, any, you know, mainstream institution. Like, if you wanted to find, say, in the 1940s, articles promoting gay rights, you would have to go to something very small, like Dwight McDonald's Politics magazine, which had a circulation of 3,000. And that's where we're not in the Times. But I think that what's more interesting is, aside from this, you know, shared cultural homophobia, there's a specific response in the magazine in the 1960s, as you start to see the sort of gay rights movement emerging even before Stonewall, that as you start to seeing more visible assertions of public queer identity and claims for rights in the 60s, that the Times isn't just at that point reflecting the mainstream, it's actually, like, taking an active position. And I think figure that I think is very important for understanding this, he's not the only person, and he might not even be the most senior person. He, in some ways, maybe he was carrying out the orders of the owners of the newspaper, but the sort of editorial, you know, lead figure of this is a fellow by the name of Abe Rosenthal. So do you want to talk about, like, you know, like, who was Abe Rosenthal, and like, what were the sort of positions that he started to lay out in the sort of 60s and 70s?
Yeah, so Abe Rosenthal, he led the Times. He was the top editor at the Times from 1969 to 1986. And he was a very senior editor before that. So he was, you know, a very, very important figure in the history of the Times. And he has a lot of big moments to his name. He led the coverage of the Pentagon Papers. He redesigned the paper, you know, from this sort of very gray and boring one section newspaper to the form that we really know today, with the style section and the art section and all those things. So he was responsible for a lot of major changes within the Times, but probably what he's...
Actually, if you want to give him, like, full credit, you know, like, he was a sort of the major patron of Seymour Hersh at the paper in the 70s, and there's no way that anyone else other than Rosenthal would have allowed Hersh to publish as many things that he did in the paper, including, you know, very important exposés of the CIA and of Henry Kissinger. So you know, like, this is, like, you know, like, to give, you know, this guy full credit, but he is a very major figure in American media.
Right. And so, you know, he had a very much lauded career at the Times for all those reasons. But really, probably now, what he's most remembered for is that he was intensely homophobic. And really, from, like, the 60s onward, when he...
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
He had a position of real influence within the Times. He worked quite assiduously to limit the coverage of queer people in the Times, and to make sure that the coverage that was there was not particularly positive. Among other things that he did in the early 60s, he personally had grown alarmed at the seeming increase in visibility of gay people in New York City. And reportedly, this is, I think, in Gay Talese's book, The Kingdom and the Power, he writes about how Abe Rosenthal personally, like, commissioned this article that wound up on the front page, all about how I think the, you know, the headline was something like growth of homosexuals in the city alarms many or something like that. And it's this very lengthy article being like, there are so many gay people on the streets that we can see, and this is terrible. You know, and then when after he ascended to the top of the ladder, interestingly, in the late 60s and then in the early 70s, you started to get hints that the attitude within the Times towards gay rights and towards gay people was softening. You know, there were some sympathetic articles. There were some sympathetic first person pieces from openly gay people talking about what it was like to be gay in the 1970s, you know, and so there was this maybe this sense that something was shifting. And then in 1975, there was an article that ran in the Sunday edition about a gay cruise. And it was, you know, it wasn't like a negative article. It was, you know, it's sort of a fun and interested piece. You know, just about this group of gay people going on a cruise. And reportedly, it so shocked not only Abe Rosenthal, but also the Sulzberger family, which owns the Times, that they raised holy hell about it. And Abe Rosenthal then decided to ban the word gay from the New York Times. So you could not, between 1975 or so and I think June 1987, if you were a writer for the New York Times, you could not describe gay people as gay. You had to describe, you know, unless you were quoting the title of some group, or unless you were quoting what someone else said, you had to use the word homosexual. So just that decision shows you just how much antipathy there was within the top leadership of the Times towards the idea that not only did gay people exist, but that you had to treat them in with anything but this sort of clinical distance, you know, because when you only rigorously use homosexual instead of gay, you know, that's this almost scientific level of, you know, an approach. And so, you know, then Rosenthal was leading the Times during, you know, really the explosion of the gay liberation movement. And then during the explosion of AIDS in the 1980s. And, you know, you can only imagine the problems that emerged because someone who was that blatantly homophobic was running the coverage of these incredibly important issues, you know. And so it was understood that he was anti-gay. It was understood by gay employees at the Times that it was not wise for them to come out. It was understood within the broader sort of culture that the Times was hostile to gay people, you know, and this had real, real consequences. You know, the Times first ran its article about AIDS, you know, it's a very famous article now, Rare Cancer Seen in 41 Homosexuals, you know, that ran in the back pages in 1981. And it took the Times almost 2 years before AIDS ran on its front page, before it decided that AIDS was worthy of A1 placement. Even then, it was at the very bottom of the page, you know. And so, you know, we don't know, as I say in the piece, we don't know, like, what would have happened if the Times had treated AIDS with the focus that it deserved. We don't know whether that would have changed things, whether it would have pushed it more into national consciousness, whether it would have you know, provoked the Reagan administration, which famously didn't mention the word AIDS for many years, to do anything. Who knows what would have happened? We only know what happened when it didn't do any of those things. And we only know how bad, you know, the plague of AIDS became, you know. And so these are very, very concrete instances of the Times choosing to take a very, very terrible position on one of the most important, you know, movements and periods of time in American social history, you know. And so, you know, the paper really had to wait for Rosenthal to leave before it could catch up to the rest of society, really, around issues of gay rights and around its own gay employees, you know. And so that has now become like a real, you know, low point in the paper's history by its own admission.
Yeah, no, I that's a good sort of survey of this. And I'll just mention that a lot of the opposition in the gay culture, the politicized movements that emerged out of AIDS in the 80s, especially ACT UP, I mean, they were targeting the Reagan administration, New York's mayor, Ed Koch, who was closeted gay man, who was very closely aligned with the Times and the Times itself. That, like, this was like a major kind of, you know, claim of ACT UP, that, like, you know, the paper's coverage was preventing an effective dealing with the plague and even an effective realization of what was going on. So,
yeah.
so this is all very, very much playing itself out in 1980s politics.
Yeah, and just briefly, you know, that leads me to one of the, like, craziest examples of this. You know, Frank Rich, who was then the theater critic of the Times in 1985, I think it was, reviewed Larry Kramer's very, very seminal play, The Normal Heart, when it ran on Broadway, and noted in the review that the Times was one of the targets that Kramer attacked in the play, and that Ed Koch was another one. You know, it was just sort of part of this list. And unbeknownst to Frank Rich, the Times management attached an editor's note to the end of his review with a statement from the Times saying, "We have not mishandled the AIDS crisis. Our coverage is good. And Larry Kramer is mistaken." And even more astonishingly than that, they also reached out to Ed Koch to get a statement from him to respond to a theater review. You know, so that really shows you not only who the Times management was aligned with during this period, but also how they were displaying the same sort of instinctive defensiveness and hostility to the notion that they could ever have gotten anything wrong about these things that they are now displaying in terms of their coverage of trans people.
No, that's right. That's right. And in fact, in some ways, I mean, that editorial note, it seems so similar to the note that their paper's current executive editor, Joseph Kahn, wrote in response to the letter. Like, it's almost exactly the same argument. Like, you know,
right?
Like, we're not getting this wrong. Trust us. There's a little side note that maybe is worth in your piece, which I think is worth exploring a little bit in terms of thinking about the dynamics here, which is that you mentioned that the early coverage of trans issues was, like, as a sort of scientific matter and in terms of, you know, telling personal stories. And I think, you know, like, a lot of people have noticed that the coverage of trans issues in some ways is going backwards, you know, like, it's regressing politically, that the earliest coverage, and this goes back to, like, the 1930s, that the earliest coverage, you know, treated it as a scientific story. There's, you know, these new medical developments, and then also as a, you know, a story about centering trans people, like, this is, you know, their experience and what's happening. And what's interesting to me is that what we see, the regression, you know, once there's much greater trans visibility in some ways comparable to the, you know, much greater gay visibility in the 60s, that you see, you know, like once trans people become visible enough that they're like a part of public life and are organized enough that they're part of public life, that's when it's a more, that's when you can stop being generous and stop being like, you know, stop treating this as a scientific and personal story and start seeing it as a threat to society. So I think that in both cases, that seems to be like the real dynamic, that the triggering point is visibility and political organization.
Yeah. And one of the sort of more enraging or poignant, really it's both parts of the piece to me is that I spoke to a woman named Donna Cartwright, who was a copy editor at the Times and who in 1998 became the first openly trans employee at the Times. You know, she went around the building and put up an open letter saying, just so everyone knows, you know, you've been working with me for years and now I am going to live my life as a woman. And she told me that, you know, despite some sort of minor difficulties, that most people within the Times were actually perfectly understanding and generous and welcoming to her. And so the idea that 25 years ago, you know, the first trans person at the Times could feel like it was a welcoming environment for her, and that all these years later, the Times is now a center for, you know, this really growing wave of anti-trans hostility, you know, is really sad to me and really angering to me, you know, and just like back then, the Times is refusing to take this seriously, even as, you know, far right legislators cite the New York Times as they, you know, introduce anti-trans bill after anti-trans bill, even after, you know, so many different people are telling them, you are getting this wrong. Nothing appears to shake them out of their certainty that, as you said, we have to trust them.
That's right. Yeah. And this might be a good note to kind of end on in terms of the sort of political impact, as you said, like, you know, especially in sort of, you know, Republican states, you're seeing a lot of anti-trans legislation. And maybe the dynamic in terms of the role the Times is playing can be compared a bit to the Guardian and other left of center papers in England, including also the New Statesman, because to some degree, those papers really took up the sort of, you know, anti-trans cause, you know, about like, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, and have really highlighted it. And we've seen them able to shift the center of a political debate, so that in England, I mean, you know, like, even 5 years ago, you were seeing some signs that the Tory party was, you know, going to come out to be more accepting of trans issues. And but because, you know, these newspapers decided to highlight anti-trans arguments so much and really mainstream them, you've seen regression with both the Tories and with Labour, with the two main parties in England. And so I think that's the real danger here, that, you know, you're seeing a mainstreaming of anti-trans sentiment and the legitimization, and that this will, you know, a lot of progress that people take for granted could very easily go away.
Absolutely. You know, and I think the analogy with the liberal media in the UK is spot on, really, because, you know, The Guardian and The New York Times do play similar roles in shaping, you know, center-left discourse within their respective countries. And it's incredibly damaging to see when they choose to go all in on these sort of anti-trans crusades in the way that they have. And yeah, you know, it's somewhat different here because, you know, the real hardcore anti-trans stuff is coming almost exclusively from within the Republican Party. It hasn't seeped into the Democratic Party in the same way that it's seeped into the Labour Party in the UK. But you know, I think it is not crazy at all to imagine that if this continues, you know, that some people within the Democratic Party will begin to say, not necessarily, you know, that they're anti-trans or anything like that, but that this is, you know, a headache. This is a culture war issue that they don't want to have to deal with. This is something that's going to, you know, affect them with the white working class, you know, all of the reasons that they usually come up with to start betraying vulnerable minority groups within this country on their way to power. You know, and the way that that kind of thing can be prevented is if the forces that are currently trying to keep trans people shut away, to eliminate them from the country and from our social and political life, you know, the only that they have to be defeated, which I think they will be defeated because that's how history usually goes in these situations. And I choose to be optimistic about that. You know, but that is not necessarily a guarantee. You know, but I do think in the end that trans people will win this fight because so many people in similar positions have won these kinds of fights before, you know. And at that point, I think it's very, very possible that the New York Times will run a similar series of searching stories about what it got wrong in the past. And to me, the important thing is not only to hold places like the Times accountable now, which I think the people who wrote the letter have done a really amazing thing by doing, but also to make sure that if or when that moment comes in the future, that people are very clear that this was not something where the Times was merely just reflecting the culture of the day, that the Times was driving this broader political movement through its coverage, and that people told it to change and that it refused to change. You know, so not only do we have to tell the Times now and all of the other media outlets and all of the other anti-trans forces out there now that this is wrong, but we can't let them pretend like people weren't saying that. You know, when the moment comes when they hold their hands up and say, I think we could have done that better.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think the moment you described is very likely to come. And I think that it's one reason I'm very happy that The Nation ran your article, because we will be in a position to say, you know, the happiest of words, we told you so.
Yes. Nothing, you know, no sweeter words in the English language.
That's right. So anyways, Jack, thanks once again for being on. This has been the Time of Monsters podcast. I would encourage everyone to, if they haven't already, to read Jack's article in The Nation.
Thank you.